support comes from the Discovery Inn on Washington's San Juan Island, an island getaway that's a ferry ride away, now taking reservations for summer and fall. More information and booking available at discoveryinn.com.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. How much does Seattle want to grow? How dense? How tall? And where? We're going to discuss that in a few minutes. Joining us today, by the way, this is shows about the week in review. Is that clear?
True story.
What happened this week? What did it mean? I have here that you just heard the voice of Brian Callanan, host and producer at Seattle Channel. Hi, Brian.
Great to be here.
And what your podcast is called?
Seattle News, Views, and Brews.
And Brews. And it's more coffee than beer?
We're working towards that. We'll
okay,
get there.
Good.
We'll get there.
We have Stranger editor Rich Smith with us. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
We have former state representative and senator Bill Finkbeiner. Former legislator, still a Republican?
No.
No longer a Republican.
We might have to discuss that. Yeah.
Okay. So, and you can, you can follow along on the show online if you like. We're working on that. Okay. So, first topic this week, you're going to be voting in November on whether to keep Washington's carbon pricing system. This is the cap and invest system meant to decrease carbon emissions and pay for climate change mitigation. The repeal campaign blames the cap and invest system for raising gas prices. This week, the No Repeal campaign launched a website and a campaign ad telling you to vote no on this initiative in November.
Because it threatens our air, land, and water. And 2117 would gut investments in transportation and jobs in our clean energy future.
The ad features a bus rider and a small business owner, an electrician, a farmer, a Suquamish council member, a mom, a firefighter. Not all one person, by the way. A series of people.
Oddly enough.
Yeah. And then the music darkens and the narrator says, "And who's behind Initiative 2117?
2117 is being pushed by one wealthy individual.
We've made a lot of progress in Washington with clean energy, and now one rich guy wants to take it all away.
A billionaire taking away transportation services for millions of people that need them is completely out of touch.
Bill, you were a legislator. Is this billionaire the only one who gets to vote in November? Because that does seem unfair
for a
single person.
It kind of sounds like when you start reading into the story, though, that it's like, you know, they're like, there's one billionaire who's pushing this, and we have eight billionaires who are against it.
Bill Gates has devoted $1 million to... These are fat cats who want to force you to vote no.
Yeah, they're winning the billionaire. And they're going to need it, too, because this is going to be a tough one for them. In 2016 and in 2018, there were initiatives on the ballot for carbon pricing, and they both went down not even close.
Tax, not cap and invest, but a carbon tax.
A carbon tax.
Right.
And it's not technically cap and invest, but it's it to some degree. And one of them in 2016, that was I-723, that was a revenue neutral. So it would have taken all the money and rolled it back into reducing the sales tax, where this is not doing that. So, I mean, I think now it's always more difficult to get rid of something than it is to put something new in.
Yes.
But, I think they're going to need all the billionaires they can get.
Yeah, and I just to jump on that, Bill, I think it's going to be interesting to watch this develop over the course of the summer. I just moderated the first of what I think is going to be many debates on 2117 on Seattle Channel. Urge people to check it out. And it was very interesting to hear these two sides of the coin on – and this is one of those difficult ones because you're voting yes on a negative here with an initiative like this, which is always interesting. So you would be voting yes to repeal the Climate Commitment Act, or you would be voting no to preserve it. And in looking at this Climate Commitment Act, quick recap here, this cap and invest system is a system where these companies purchase these allowances for pollution, right? And there's a cap to that. That cap lowers every year. And so as they go through that, the whole incentive is for these companies to be greener and try to have their systems be cleaner and less polluting. The interesting thing with the gas prices, and this is where I know a lot of people don't like nuance when they vote, but it's there.
I hate nuance.
I know.
Don't do that to
in
me.
General, right? No, and that's the whole issue. The very simple argument for the yes campaign is like, hey, look at our gas prices. Vote yes on this, and that's an answer. I will say, in talking with some different people at the state level, Department of Ecology as well, that whole idea of coupling together the idea of gas prices and these allowances is a little tricky because last year, 2023, these allowances first started going for sale. The prices of those go up and the gas prices go up. So, okay, there's the connection right there. But then this year, those prices for the allowances are about 50% cheaper. The one that was just wrapped up, the quarterly auction that just wrapped up in March, those prices were 50% cheaper for the allowances, and yet still gas prices are going up. So I think that's going to be the real challenge for the No campaign, is to try to decouple those gas prices there. Are they going to be able to do it? Again, it's a lot of nuance to try to jam in, and I'm not quite sure how that's going to go.
Yeah, I think they might try by talking about all the benefits that the money goes to.
Of course.
We're talking about free transit for, you know, people under 18, so, you know, free train rides for the youth. We're talking about massive investments in communities that have been on the front lines of you know, climate change and have dealt with the deleterious effects of that. So they might just try this positive message, but who knows? I mean, there might not just be one Republican billionaire backing the yes on the no campaign.
Right.
Well, yeah, and the yes on the repeal campaign.
And the other way I think that they're going to try to work this forward over the course of this year, it's going to be looking up in the skies. And I don't want it to happen, but let's say we do have a really bad fire season yet again.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to turn into a political fodder very quickly. I think that this no campaign is working east of the mountains, all over the state, as a matter of fact, to say, hey, guess what? This whole situation, and I hear what you're saying, Bill, with regard to these different carbon tax programs of the past,
mm-hmm.
but I just think we're in a different space now when mm-hmm. it comes to being aware of climate, being aware of forest fires that are now really happening every year in our region here. And so if that can turn into a little bit of a political issue, that either side is going to try to use it in some way. But I really do feel like the No campaign is going to be focusing on that and trying to get this message across east of the mountains, because that's where they're going to have a lot of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Although you have this collective action problem with climate change, that it's not that we on our own with a Washington state cap and invest system are going to affect the climate.
No.
So it becomes more of an either philosophical or ethical, or let's be the leaders. Someone's got to lead this.
Yeah.
You know, enough people make a minuscule difference starts to add up to a difference. We don't know how voters are going to think that through.
We don't know how, and there isn't a great way to actually measure what the impact of this CCA has been so far. Yes, they started with these carbon allowances and these auctions or whatever else, but is there a number you can point to that says, hey, take a look, our climate looked like this before and now it is X percent better? You know, that's the very difficult part to visualize here. I think Senator Joe Wen brought it up, like everybody wants the great abs, but they don't want to work out, you know, so it's like, how are we going to get through this?
So I see myself in that.
Yeah, right. No, I resemble that comment. But it's one of those kind of things where I think you're very right that that's something that people have a difficult time wrapping around. Climate change is very real. I will say, however, though, when it comes to teaming up with other places in Washington, the state of Washington, and trying to team up with the state of California and Quebec.
And Quebec.
Yeah, with some of this carbon pricing activity. I think that can start to make the case a little bit more regionally, but
yeah.
You really do need more places to join in on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear you on that. I'm a little bit like,
Is this the abs comment?
Yeah. No.
I've been trying to work out more, Rich. I promise. Yeah.
No, I mean,
just
hear,
tell them what you think.
I hear you on the it's a new dawn, it's a new day. People are thinking about climate change in a new way, but like, you know, it's also, I see it as related to the $30
totally.
You know, car tab type initiative.
Same playbook. Yep.
Yeah, where, you know, a lot of Washingtonians just want to spend less money on the thing that they use every day, which
yeah.
a lot of them, unfortunately, you know, is their cars. And
yeah.
so I could see it going that way. They've got, what, 800 or 1,000 free billboards
right.
That in the form of gas stations
yep.
Driving home that message every single day. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some pretty extreme measures out of the refineries in Washington. Maybe they stop work for a couple of days because it's too expensive to work, or some kind of political thing. I'm just
yeah.
getting
yeah.
Head tax
maybe.
Bill, you still talk Republican. Would that happen?
I mean,
you speak Republican.
As far as like how are people gonna be on this, I do think it's changing. I worked pretty hard on I-732, the revenue neutral
mm-hmm.
one. It was heartbreaking when that thing failed. I mean, it didn't just fail; it just got stomped.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I remember talking to the most amazing conversations. I mean, businesses that were general contractors,
yeah.
big time general contractors who were paying, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales tax. I'm like, look, you're going to have your sales tax reduced by this thing, and you're going to pay a little more for gas. And they go, I never forget this. They go, our customers pay the sales tax. I'm like, oh, really? Wow. That's how you see it? Wow. I think there's one gas tax is like the one tax that everybody pays. Most people don't pay their property tax. It comes out of your mortgage or your landlord pays it or something. Most people, you know, the sales tax, you just don't notice because it's just – but the gas tax, it's like, whoa, you know, people are aware of that for some reason. And it's a tough one.
Okay.
Now, obviously, this isn't a gas tax.
Right.
A, but I do think it's – you know, I think Brian, you should go on and do the ads for him because you explain it really well. But it's complicated and it's stuck in people's minds. I think that there's a correlation with the gas price.
I did want to ask Bill, when you think about these different companies that are joining in, like BP, which is it runs our state's largest refinery. When you've got Amazon, which has probably the largest carbon footprint in our state, does the support of big companies like that help a campaign like this? Or
Amazon and Microsoft are supporting this initiative. So a no on the November initiative.
Right.
I think absolutely it helps. I think it definitely helps in the sense that people are like, you know, there's a lot of business owners or people that are like concerned about the business climate. And they're like, hey, if these businesses are for it, it makes sense that, you know, it's not as scary as maybe some people are saying. So I think it's definitely going to be closer, I think, than the ones were before. I think people are starting to change, too.
Just real quick on that, I will say the Yes campaign would say the money's getting funneled to these big companies, and then it comes out in a hidden gas tax to the people who are paying it, just to wrap that up.
Yeah.
It also helps.
Might have a point.
Oh, it also helps in the sense that they're not going to be spending money on the anti side or on the repeal side, and which I think Democratic lawmakers who helped shape the bill ensured by bringing BP and those players into the table to help write the bill when it passed.
Okay, fair enough. Speaking of state politics, Republicans are in Spokane for their state convention. Among other things, they'll decide who to endorse for Congress and governor. Former President Trump is backing a challenger to incumbent Congressmember Dan Newhouse. Has Trump endorsed someone for governor? I think Semi Byrd endorsed Trump, or is backs Trump basically. Semi Byrd is in the polls is far behind Dave Reichert, former member of Congress. But the state Republicans might endorse the non frontrunner.
Ooh. Right. Yes, they're having their convention this weekend, and they get to decide who are they going to go for. And, yeah, it's between Semi Byrd and Dave Reichert for the most part. And the scuttlebutt is that a lot of the – you know, it's a delegate process, so it's a lot of party insiders deciding this, and a lot of the PCOs and some of the party insiders are really for Byrd. And the issue with that comes down to – money, because this year the Washington State Republican Party has devoted the full and exclusive support of the party to whoever wins the nomination. So if Byrd wins the nomination, then all of the money would flow through the party and then go to Byrd. Or since Byrd doesn't really have a very good shot of winning right now, the money might go into an IE and support Reichert. And so you have the Republicans fractured in terms of how the money might go, which might have other people looking at someone like a mullet, right? So maybe the big corporate money goes, well, maybe we'll go with a Democrat who has a better shot of winning and he wants to cut our taxes or whatever. So it really has the, you know, this weekend, I'll be excited to see what happens this weekend.
You'll be texting me a lot?
I wish I was going. They didn't invite me.
Did he invite you, Bill?
No. Okay. I haven't been to the state convention in a long time. It's a big deal, the state party's ability to spend. A lot of people don't realize it's I can't remember what it comes out. It's like a $2 or $3 per registered voter or something like that. So their ability to spend and coordinate with the campaign is unique. And so, like you're saying, if the money goes into an independent expenditure, it really has to be separate from the campaign. So it's just not as effective. So it's a big deal, and it's clearly. It's clearly Reichert's, I think, would have a huge uphill battle, but is the only one that has a chance out of the two of them. Mm-hmm. And, it'll be interesting.
Well, I just kind of thought it was a win for Republicans, if you want to call it that we're talking about it right now. And there's some new energy in the party in our state. And I think this leads back to initiatives like 2117, which comes from Jim Walsh, the representative from the 19th District down in Aberdeen, the Republican there. And
from the billionaire.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what I'm saying. But he worked with that billionaire, Brian Haywood. Yeah. to put together this raft of initiatives for Let's Go Washington. Mm-hmm. And really, I have to say, kind of took over Olympia this past session. So I think they're seeing some new energy from that in terms of who they're going to bring out with this process here in Spokane over the weekend. I guess it's a difficult choice in some way, but I think Bird, if he were the candidate, I just think he would get trounced in the general election.
He's got no money. Yep. He's got the COVID denial stuff that led to his recall from the school board in Richmond. He's had some legal troubles in the past. It's a tough row to hoe for him.
I think all those things and just pale in comparison that he's going to tie himself to Trump, who got, you know, whatever, 40% of the vote in the state 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and is probably going to, you know, do about that again. And he's, you know, obviously, you know, taken over the party structure, which is why they're still looking at and, you know, endorsing Byrd, even with those challenges.
Wow. We mentioned Republican gubernatorial candidate Dave Reichert. Reichert's leading opponent this week, Democrat Bob Ferguson, released a video criticizing Reichert for comments made at a February fundraiser. Here is an excerpt of what Reichert said in response to an audience member asking, how do you define a woman?
Number one, my wife is a woman and I'm a man. You're a woman and I'm a man. There's only man and woman. I was raised as a Christian, and marriage is between a man and a woman. I don't believe that transgender men should be competing against girls and women in sports.
I assume he meant to say transgender women, not transgender men. Here is an excerpt from the campaign ad that Ferguson posted in response.
Washington can't afford to send someone like Congressman Reichert with bigoted, homophobic views to the governor's office. Saying that marriage is only between a man and a woman is completely out of touch with the people of Washington state.
Now, Reichert's campaign says he would not try to restrict same-sex marriage if he were to be elected governor. Rich, do you find that believable?
I think that he would want to, but I don't think that he can, because he would have to. I mean, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but the Democrats look poised to probably increase their majorities in the Senate and the House. And as governor, I don't think he would have the unilateral power to tank marriage. However, with this SCOTUS, Supreme Court in place, marriage is certainly under threat nationwide.
Same-sex marriage.
Yeah. Same-sex marriage, yeah. Mm-hmm. Equal marriage is under threat. And as governor, he could veto. So if any expansions to LGBTQ rights or, you know, come through the legislature, I wouldn't be shocked at all.
Or transgender rights, from the main body of his remark there.
Absolutely, yeah, which are also under assault nationwide, and which the legislature keeps pushing each year, especially in terms of medical care. I could absolutely see him vetoing that. Yeah.
It just seemed, I was trying to put it in context in terms of where these comments were made by Reichert. I mean, he's talking to a base there. He's talking to a right-wing base that is clearly going to be clapping for him for these different statements or whatever else. I just wonder how he would try to change that message on a larger statewide level. And I just think about, I mean, he was in office from 2005 to 2019, and Has he been, just in terms of being away from the political scene for 4 years during a time when COVID changed a lot in our world, and certainly what happens with politics here. And I just really wonder about this. I think this is a real challenge to him. I think it's something that Bob Ferguson clearly is capitalizing on here. But I just wonder about this. And I think it brings some important questions that hope Reichert answers during his candidacy.
He's been doing this thing where he's like, I'm a cop who protected abortion in 1974 or whatever. I stood, mm-hmm. I cleared the way at the Planned Parenthood so that people could get a bunch of abortions. So I will be a cop for gay marriage. I may not like gay marriage. Mm-hmm. I may erase trans people entirely from my life and, you know, or whatever.
But I will put my life on the line.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we'll see. I don't think that the I mean, you know, he's trying to get the sort of right-leaning independent voters who might be thinking about voting blue in the governor's race because Trump man bad on his side. Mm. I don't know if this is a good way of doing that. And I don't know if they'll buy the, you know, I was a cop, I defended, you know, abortion sort of line. But
That's exactly what he's going to want to talk about. And he's just going to want to say police, law and order, and every single time he's on. And Ferguson's going to want to say he's coming after same-sex marriage, and he's coming after, you know, all this and choice.
Abortion,
exactly, which is why Ferguson ran this thing out.
What do you think listeners should know about this?
Well, I think a couple things. One is I think that I think not only is he talking to a group that probably he's, you know, thinks is going
to
agree with
him. Yeah.
I think that's also probably not too far away from what he probably thinks, you know. I think he's going to phrase it like Rich said, you know, that, hey, even if I disagree, I'm going to, you know, be a cop here. I also think, regardless of what he thinks, there's no way it's going to happen, right? I mean, first of all, 70% of this state, I think, now supports same-sex marriage, which is a lot of Republicans, like not a small amount of Republicans. And Republicans helped pass it in the state legislature and pass it in Congress. So it's, you know, it's regardless of what he thinks or what he wants to do, it's not going to happen. Now, I think other issues around that, trans issues, are probably, you know, going to be more in debate. But I also think you're exactly right, too. There, it's going to be a strong Democratic legislature. So, you know, then people have to decide, okay, how much do they care about whether this person is actually going to do these things, or does he just disagree with me on these things, you know?
Yeah, well, and on the trans issue, we saw some indication of Bob Ferguson initially kind of stepping back from it, right? I mean, his whole campaign where he put out this video stressed the marriage line, but that marriage line came in the context of I'm a man. There's only woman. There's only man. This erasing of transness from the world. And Bob Ferguson did not mention that in his fundraising email or in the video. He did mention it. You know, and we asked him why over at The Stranger, and he said we're focusing on one issue at a time. There's going to be plenty of, you know, time to hit Reichert on this issue. And also, like, you know, Bob Ferguson has a history of standing up for trans rights, and Reichert erases them. And the day after, he sent out a text, or not a text, but a tweet Bob Ferguson did, saying that the, you know, erasure of trans people is okay, bad and no good or whatever. But it was the day after. So some indication that, you know, that he may be, he's thinking about the politics.
They're both going to just try to stay on message. And Reichert's, it's going to be, you know, crime and law and order. And Ferguson, it's going to be choice and same-sex marriage. So Reichert was off message, and I'm sure his team reminded him of that.
Stay in your lane.
Immediately after, you know, he walked
out. A fundraiser is still a campaign. A private fundraiser is still a campaign. Yeah. Okay, last thing before we take a break, since we started off on state politics here. Rich, you made a quick reference there to Democrats possibly adding to their majorities. Why do you say that?
It is feasible this year, especially with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, for the House and the Senate to pick up the number of lawmakers they would need to have a constitutional majority in the legislature, which would give them the power to change the state constitution.
60% or two-thirds?
Yeah, two-thirds.
Something like
that. Two-thirds,
okay.
Yeah. I can't remember the magic numbers in both houses, but there are magic numbers in both houses. And with the redistricting, the court redistricting that happened recently, a lot of these districts are new now. Some incumbents have been kicked out or have to move back in or are leaving. And so there's really a potential for a number of pickups this year for Democrats. It could be major it could change the face of Washington, or it could not.
I was going to say,
we got you covered, listeners.
Right. What?
One of those two things.
What policies? I mean, if indeed they do get that supermajority, what policies do you think they go after? And I ask this because they've had some strong majorities over the past several years here, and with that, a number of those policies have been rolled back. I'm thinking about police pursuits and things of that nature. But do you have some thoughts about that? What do you think they would actually chase after in terms of issues?
I asked them, and the answer is it depends because, you know, the election cycle giveth and the election cycle taketh away. In brief, 2026 does not look like a great year for Washington State Democrats, particularly in the Senate. They have to defend all their seats. And so if they get that power in 2024, the question is how do they use it?
Yeah.
Do they use it to reach for the stars and do big things like some say, or some lawmakers have mentioned, change the gift of public funds language so that the state can just give money directly to people. Or
school levies, too.
The thing that all Democrats want and probably would agree on would be changing the school bond threshold to 50% so that people can tax themselves.
They can pass those
school levies in the rural zones. And maybe some abortion protections or protections around guns or something that, like, 60, 70, 80% of the state might like. So, or do nothing and show that they have the power, but they're not going to use it because they're that responsible.
Oh, boy.
Keep electing us Democrats, and we won't use power at all statewide.
Worst tagline ever. Yeah, right.
But, Bill Finkbeiner, don't we have in Washington State an unusually easy, quote-unquote, path to voter initiatives, which gives some element, more of an element of minority rule in our state than other states?
Well, theoretically, minority rule, like if you're an initiative, is everybody's voting on it. So it's not – so
– we've seen the success of that in Washington State.
Yeah. This session, what I'd say more is that that's not – I mean, I guess the minority caucus in Olympia was protected by that. And I think the I think that the majority, especially big majorities,
I suppose I shouldn't say minority rule when we're talking about an initiative.
Yeah.
I mean, what it cuts against the legislative dominance when you can
when you have one party that's got strong majorities in Olympia, and I think that's exactly what happened. And I think when you're in those situations, the parties tend to go further than probably most people would have expected them to. And I think that they're not going to say, "Yeah, well, here's all the changes we're going to make to the Constitution," until the November 8th or whatever,
right?
The week after the election, then they're going to say, here's the things. And they might, even if they have an aggressive agenda there, getting two-thirds is a lot. If you need every single person, that starts to add up to a lot. It also starts to it just blows my mind. I can't ever remember a time when either, House or Senate was ever close to two-thirds. And it's
60s.
Yeah. You're really going back, and maybe like the 30s, and even then, they were those coalitions within the parties. Those parties were almost two parties in a way. They were much less cohesive than these parties are now. So it makes me wonder if there's room for a third party when you start to get two thirds. It really does start to feel like, okay, maybe there is, and it's always been difficult to see a third party get started, but it starts to feel like maybe people start to get disenfranchised, and within that big coalition start to feel like, well, maybe I'm on one side or the other, that big coalition instead of,
Wouldn't that be interesting?
I've got breaking news.
Good fodder for your show, Bill.
Yeah, right. That's right. I've got breaking news on the GOP convention front. The executive board of the Republican Party just decided to make Semi Byrd ineligible for the endorsement based on the Seattle Times article about his previous conviction. It was a misdemeanor bank larceny conviction or whatever. So drama in the GOP.
Did they just wriggle out of that? So now
they may have just wriggled out of that problem that we were mentioning earlier about with the split
possible
pack.
Endorsement of someone who's far behind in the polls and money.
Yeah,
well, interesting. Limiting
good grab, Rich.
Good grab, Rich.
Wow. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay,
and Reichert's future chief of staff, possibly.
Yes. Right. Can't beat him, join him, sure. Right.
Okay, let's take a pause. We are reviewing the week for you because the show's called Week in Review, and I feel obligated, with a title like that to review the week. So let's keep doing it. It's going well, don't you think?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
let's
pause. Let's talk about what else happened this week and help you understand it with my guests, Brian Callanan from Seattle Channel, Rich Smith at The Stranger, Bill Finkbeiner. What are you? You're not
out
legislating, so what are you doing? You're
just on my show. Real estate investment. Yeah.
Real estate investment. Great. Well, let's talk. I want to retire soon. Okay.
Right after this show.
How do I buy a house? They're so expensive.
That was a joke
back
on my part.
30 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's pause and come right back with more Week in Review.
Support comes from Pacific Science Center, working to inspire the next generation of scientists and increase access to STEM education statewide through digital discovery workshops, science on wheels, and summer camps. More ways to support these efforts at pacsci.org.
You rely on this podcast to stay informed and connected with your local community, and we rely on you. Without listener support, this show simply wouldn't exist. Be a part of the team that makes this show possible by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute. Donate at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thank you.
This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I am surrounded by Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan. I've got former legislator Bill Finkbeiner here, former Republican, and we have Stranger editor Rich Smith. Next up, Seattle is having this civic debate about growth. How much should we upzone and fill in and build up and where versus having fewer homes, keeping some neighborhoods mostly single family with lawns and gardens and driveways? Is that a fair characterization, Brian, so
far?
That's
about right, yeah.
Okay, so this week, the pro-density news site The Urbanist reported that city planners had proposed more density than Mayor Harrell wanted, and the mayor's office scaled it back. Also accurate? You agree with that?
Believe so. That's what I'm seeing in the report, and I talked a little bit with Tammy Morales, who is the land use committee chair on the city council, mm-hmm. about this this week on Seattle Channel, and she really had some concerns about this and reiterated her point that basically what the mayor is proposing with this comprehensive plan that he's put forward is this idea that it's basically the status quo. We're kind of staying where we are. And so this idea that these neighborhood centers, which look like a really great attractor for small businesses and things of that nature, it looks like there were close to 50 of them presented initially by this group, scaled back to about 24 by the mayor's office. And so that's a big concern.
So not status quo, but less than what some...
I'm saying status quo in terms of where our comprehensive plan was beforehand compared to now.
It was already allowing growth.
Right.
I think Erica C. Barnett said on this show that it was the do-nothing option would have been 20% less growth than this option.
Right, right. And it's important to point out cities all across...
Erica also is coming from a point of view on this, an urbanist point of view.
This is true. This is true. And I will point out, this is something that cities across the state are going through right now. All the cities across the state have to renew their comprehensive plans. It's a 10-year process, and this is happening for a lot of people right now. So I know it's something the Councilmember Morales is concerned about, and I will say that there is a process going forward for people to get in their input on this. There are a number of different public meetings out there. You need to get in your comments by May 6th, but the city is really looking for input here on this.
Good point. Oh, so let's highlight that. Listeners, if you care, if you're in Seattle, you've got, that's less than 3 weeks.
Yeah,
to submit
contact your council member, and they will direct you to this One Seattle plan that the mayor's put forward, and you can comment on it.
Put a little bit of a finer point on it. If you would like to afford a house anytime in the next, or a place to live in the next 10 years, you may want to check into all this talk about the comprehensive plan, because we are 120,000 units short here. And when we say status quo, we mean just planning for the growth over the course of the next 10 years that we expect based on jobs, not accounting for the deficit and planning. So that's why people like Eric are saying we're so far behind.
And I feel sorry for those planners too, because my guess is they were assuming that what people said they wanted, more affordable housing, is what they wanted, so they go aggressive, and then it's like, well, that's not, we want that, but we don't want anything to change. It's a tough line. I've spent a lot of time at planning commission meetings in Bellevue the last 3 or 4 months, and it's a tough line to walk. There's just so many different stakeholders, and the biggest one is the status quo. Don't change things. People just...
That's human.
It is. Yeah. People don't like change. And I'd say it's not all people. I always think of this. I had a teacher, I can't remember, in grade school somewhere, and twice a year she'd go in and she'd just move around all the desks.
Awesome.
And, so here's what I remember. One time somebody asked her, why do you do that? And she said, I just think it gets people sort of a fresh perspective. And she said, it's so funny. When the kids walk in, 1/3 of them look at it and go, oh, no. What is happening here? Mm. 1/3 of them look at it and go, oh, interesting. And 1/3 of them look at it and go, awesome.
Right.
This is fun. And it's people just, I think there's a lot of folks that just feel that have a hard time seeing that change. But the thing is that you don't get things for nothing. And so in order to have affordable housing, you have to put these densities in there.
Well, I think change is a very nice way of putting it. The change that they don't want to see is more people living next to them, and especially people who they maybe don't think are as invested in the community. There is stigma, for instance, against renters who say that they, you know, the renters, unlike homeowners, have no stake in the history of the city. I have been in the same apartment for 10 years. I don't foresee ever leaving this apartment. I'm a renter with a very
Your
big
landlord stick. Will be happy to hear that.
Yes, yes. Well,
the rent just went up.
It's kind of a mixed bag.
It did.
Right, it literally did. Right.
But yeah. But it's I would love to own and stop throwing away money, you know, on rent and build some equity for once in my life. But I can't because we don't have enough places for me to move into. Right. And so, and not to impugn anyone's motives, but the people who live in renter, you know, apartments to be more diverse, black and brown people. Well, they come in on transit lines, you know.
And if I own a house, if you're telling me that the more homes we build, the cheaper housing will become, you're telling me you're going to lower my property value.
Yeah.
So you could also put greed in that, or at least this is part of why what I think makes the conversation so hard. I don't know who wants change and who's elitist or who's greedy, but we seem to be judging each other's motives.
Yeah.
There feels like a real a negativity about the conversation.
Maybe, and I guess it's a fact of life, and it's a problem that I think maybe a lot of cities would want to have in that. The problem I'm talking about is we've got huge tech businesses here which are attracting so many jobs, and it's a great thing to happen to see all this kind of growth in Seattle. However, when you bring in those high-paying jobs, a lot of people describe this as something called downrenting. Hey, they could afford to pay $2,000 a month, but they're actually going to pay $1,500. So that $1,500 person might end up getting pushed down to $1,000 and so forth, to a point where sometimes, and this has been borne out in some of the research put out there, when these rents go up in a certain way, it makes X amount of people homeless. I mean, that's the spectrum we're talking about here. So when you see this success of Seattle, which is great to see, a lot of cities, I would say, would love to have that kind of problem. But it brings with it some unintended consequences, which equal a lot of housing problems for us.
Well, I want to bounce a listener reaction. We have this community feedback club for KUOW listeners. And I got some thoughtful comments and questions here. So Matt in Beacon Hill says, I think we desperately need greater density to stabilize the cost of housing. I also think it's one of the best ways to pursue the city's goal of reducing reliance on cars. I am, Matt continues, a bit conflicted, though, because one of the things I cherish about my neighborhood is that it's relatively peaceful and all the gardens are so beautiful. Is it worth suffering the cost of housing to preserve that?
Yeah, I think there's real trade-offs. I think it's, It changes the character of a place when it goes from single family homes to multifamily, and not the character. I don't think everybody's just saying, "Oh, these are different people." It's like, well, you know, if everybody's got a yard and your kids are riding their bikes in the street, and then it gets more dense, you know, that can be difficult.
You mean traffic?
Exactly. There's some traffic. Traffic, just more. You get more people. Yeah, more traffic. It's like it's not as quiet. But the flip side of that is it's obviously just a critical problem, the affordable housing. I mean, it's hitting young people especially hard in my mind. And the people that I see that are most often coming in saying, let's not change the zoning are usually not younger people. It's usually older people. I think it's just got to be done. You have to have housing. The number of people that are moving, just like you were saying, here, Brian, is not going to slow down. Bellevue's got the same thing, 30,000 new homes in the next 20 years.
I would say two things. One, my apartment complex has a beautiful rose garden tended to by a woman named Rose, and that's a lovely thing that happens in my life. Isn't that wonderful?
That's cool.
Second thing, we've got a refugee crisis right now because we can't find any homes to put these people in.
Right.
And I think that when we're talking about trade-offs, it's not just sort of like, should I do this or this? It's like, do you want to have a amorphous concept of flowers and gardens or in quiet, or do you want to live in a city where we can help people
in a home? Is that amorphous? Concrete and trees and gardens. Do we have to choose between those things and density?
It's a percentage is what it turns into. So it's like, all right, you're going to have this amount of setback rather than that amount of setback. You're going to have this amount of green space, maybe a little bit less than what we have now in certain areas. And so there are some trade-offs here, like you're saying, Bill, and that's where the sausage is made, basically. It's like, okay, how much are we going to slice out of this neighborhood? How much are we going to slice out of this green space? I know that the city does want to preserve that, but this is the clash that we're running into. And where these things go, you talk about building affordable housing, it takes a while for these things to go. Yeah. Even with shovel-ready projects, it takes a while for these things to get going. And, Bill, you've probably run into this in some of your work. It takes some time, and we needed these things yesterday.
And these plans are 20-year plans.
Right.
That's, I think really the thing that took a while for me to understand is this isn't about people who are living here today. This is about people who are going to be living here in 20 years.
Right.
And when I say there's trade-offs, it's like, okay, yeah, there's no free lunch, but there's also a ton of benefits that come with more urban areas. You have more restaurants. You have more. It's more walkable. You're definitely going to reduce carbon footprint. You're going to, you're going to have a transit system that can actually function easier. All these things that are huge benefits, along with more affordable housing. So it's, I'm just saying, it's like, you don't get everything you have now and all this other stuff. It's like, okay, there's going to be, good and bad things that happen when you increase density. But I think the region, it feels like, what I feel sorry for these planners is I feel like everybody's saying, yes, density, we have to get going. We're so far behind. But that is sort of the other side of their mouth, but not too fast.
But wait, in my neighborhood? Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
In fact, didn't that just happen this week in a sense? I mean, arguably, you can tell me, but the chair of that committee you just were mentioning, Tammy Morales, proposed an idea to help. This was how she said this would help people stay in their neighborhoods.
Right.
The people who are getting pushed out with growth and gentrification. And so you can tell me whether that's you think that's an accurate characterization, but her idea didn't go anywhere. She didn't get a single other vote. She's the chair of the committee.
It was one of the saddest moments in Seattle Channel TV history in a lot of ways. And I say that because this really doesn't happen. When you talk about what happens at the council committee level, this is not a situation where things get that do not pass vote. It's generally, okay, let's bring this to the full council and we'll talk about it. I've got some questions about it, but let's bring it to the full council. This was a flat out no. Right. We're talking about three people on this committee that turned into the majority here. And they said this connected communities legislation, a pilot program that would have run through 2029. It felt like pretty low hanging fruit for the council to be working together on it. And I should point out, the first actual substantive legislation they were looking at this year with an actual vote to it, not a proclamation, but an actual ordinance that would go into effect, a program that would go into effect. But it was a flat out no. And I think
was there something wrong with her idea that it wouldn't achieve what she thought it would achieve, or what really happened?
That argument was there. And I think the most cogent argument I heard was from Councilmember Kathy Moore, who said, all right, this pilot sounds great, but we should really be trying to push this out to all parts of the city. And we can do that with the comprehensive plan. Is that possible? I'm not entirely sure. I really think that this pilot could have done something here, and it was certainly a difficult time for Councilmember Morales in looking at this, and she was flabbergasted. I mean, very disappointed in what happened.
It was supposed
here.
To help nonprofits
build and develop
affordable housing.
That's right, and it would have helped out 35 of these different projects over the course of 5 years or so. And it's just one of those, and I think you'll hear this from a lot of different developers. Sally Bagshaw used to say this on the council, we need buckshot, not just one silver bullet here. There have to be a lot of different ways to handle a problem here. And so this was one way. The council apparently didn't like it. I'm not 100% sure why, but it's clear that Councilmember Morales has to do some more work to build a consensus here. She will be coming back to the full council at the end of April on April 30th to try to see if she can garner some more support for this. But this committee vote, do not pass, was a real step back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the NIMBYs have gotten very good at not talking like NIMBYs. The major thing that has come from the voice of the NIMBY lately is that we just don't like this density because it leads to displacement, our vulnerable communities, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then here is this ordinance that comes along that would literally address it's the exact kind of development that they're looking for. It prevents displacement. We've got Ethiopian and Cambodian communities who want to build community centers, and they want their people to be able to go to those community centers and live close to them rather than living down in Federal Way so they can actually make use of them. And then we get no because let's handle it in the comp plan, or no because trees, parking minimums, or that sort of thing. So it's it makes me raise questions about the sincerity of the of some of the views held there by the council members.
Okay, let's take a break. A couple more listener comments before we break. Stu in West Seattle told us, I love the out-of-doors, green spaces, privacy, single-family homes with yards and gardens. It's a very civilized way to live. in neighborhoods that share identities and friendships. The more dense, the more people isolate. Do parents really want to raise their kids in 600-square-foot apartments surrounded by concrete, fighting with their neighbors over parking? In the end, the only remaining single-family neighborhoods will be occupied by the relatively few super wealthy. Any reaction before I move on?
Oh, boy.
Okay.
I'm paralyzed. Chicago, New York, yes, families are being raised in apartments. I was raised in an apartment. I wasn't even
in a
city.
And look how you turned out.
He's a poet.
Talking to you.
Right.
Well, that's Stu's point of view. Nancy and Roosevelt says the biggest advantage to the density is a lot more people on the street, which feels safer.
Yes.
And more things like restaurants and coffee shops.
Yes.
The biggest con has been the loss of naturally affordable housing, such as older apartment buildings. In my single-family neighborhood, I would welcome more 4-to-6-unit apartment buildings with ground floor units that are accessible to older people and people with disabilities. So that's part of the argument, too. Well, do new apartment buildings mean lowering prices or raising prices that we don't have time to settle right here because we're doing a live show with more things to say about what happened this week? So even though Rich's mouth is open, I guess I'm shutting it.
I'm sorry.
I know. Okay. Well, listen, if you want to join that conversation, you can join KOW's Community Feedback Club. You can go to kow.org/feedback, a simple, or you can text the word club to a number I'm about to give you, 206-926-9955. Again, 206-926-9955.
Join the club.
Yeah, join the feedback club. Brian, a new podcast name for you, Buckshot Spotter.
Consider it. I like it.
Okay, we got to take a break and then more Week in Review. We'll be right back. We got to go back on the air, Rich. I do want to hear about what you're saying.
This is important.
We'll start a new show for the animation.
I came up with a better podcast name. I would disagree with Rich all the time and we'd call it Rich, Please.
Yeah.
I think it would work out well.
Interesting. That was Brian Callanan's idea. He's from Seattle Channel.
Sure.
We got Rich Smith from The Stranger and a former Republican legislator, Bill Finkbeiner. Is it okay if I even call you a former Republican legislator?
Yeah.
You're not disavowing your only your party, not your past. Okay.
Neither of them.
Okay. Yes. Very good. Oh, not your party?
Well, I'm no longer a member of the Republican Party.
Fair enough. Okay, quick things before we go, because the show's almost over. Things I haven't mentioned, the state declared a drought emergency for almost all of Washington. Snowpack is low. Forecast models suggest above normal temps, below normal rain. Obviously bad news for salmon and agriculture, hydropower, drinking water.
Fires,
thank you. The place is not under a drought emergency or around here, including Seattle Public Utilities, places with big water supply systems and reservoirs. Lots of other spots have or will have voluntary or mandatory water restrictions. And maybe in Seattle, too. I don't know. Number two, more Boeing criticism. This week it was a U.S. Senate subcommittee hearing. A Boeing engineer testified that the company's taking manufacturing shortcuts that could lead to 777s and 787s breaking apart. And he said he saw factory workers jumping on sections of fuselage to make them line up. Boeing says this is bunk, that they have tested, they have inspected. There were no findings of fatigue or cracking in the composite panels and that modern materials like carbon fibers and resin are nearly impervious to fatigue, unlike old aluminum fuselages. And a USC engineering professor said moving Boeing headquarters out of Seattle made it harder to watch for human factors that can undermine safety. Number three, there was a pro-Palestinian rush hour protest at SeaTac Airport on Monday. The city of SeaTac has charged 46 people with misdemeanors. All of them are out on bail. The airport told the Seattle Times that about 24 flights were delayed, mostly for 20 minutes or less. Any reaction to that before we smile at the end of the show? About covered it?
That was a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you came through it.
Thank you. It's lung capacity. Singing lessons.
That's right.
Okay, so finally we have time to say what we smiled about this weekend. And I think it's clear the suggestion is the listeners might smile as well. It's not really about us.
Yeah.
But for example, remember the ice bucket challenge
right.
a few years ago? This is when you dump ice over somebody's head for a good cause. Most famous was in 2014 to raise awareness of ALS. Here's me doing it back at that time with my young kids.
Hey, you guys, that's not ice water.
It's ice coffee.
we have to do it again?
So, well.
Wow.
Well, the Seattle version of the chat.
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my kids were heavy coffee drinkers. Well, we have a natural version of this here because Puget Sound is so dang cold even in the springtime. So this weekend, Pearl Jam singer Eddie Vedder will and others will help raise awareness of the rare genetic disease Epidermolysis bullosa by plunging into Puget Sound at Alki Beach that Sunday at 10 o'clock.
That's awesome.
All right on.
Yeah.
And what about you? Anything? Rich, you look, I don't know what look on your face that is. You look like you're lost in thought.
I was thinking about a polar plunge. And the last time I did one and the smile on my face that I held after I got out
because it was frozen.
Because
yes.
I was frozen
right,
solid.
Right, right.
Smiling because it stopped.
Yeah. But like
Immortus. Yeah, but I'm smiling in addition to that because there's a new Taylor Swift album out. I guess I'm ambivalent on Taylor Swift, but there I did hear one of the songs mention a kid in a Jehovah's Witness in a little suit. I'm Jewish. My mother is Jewish, but she converted to be a Jehovah's Witness, and so I was raised a Jehovah's Witness. And so anytime I hear Jehovah's Witnessism or whatever in popular culture, I'm like, wow, yeah.
It's all about you.
Yeah, exactly. I exist.
Well, now I'm going to smile, too, when I hear about Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, great.
Anybody
great.
Else? We got like a minute left.
I was smiling about the reopening of Highway 20. It actually happened this morning, the North Cascades Highway. Always a good sign that spring is here. I know it's getting warmer, and this is actually earlier than they usually do it here in April, but it always brings a smile on my face. One of the most beautiful stretches of roadway you will find in the Northwest.
Yeah, making the most out of the early climate change opening.
Right,
a beautiful
scene.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Got that going earlier for us. Yeah, right.
Do I have time? All right.
Yes.
Well, it might come as a surprise to you and listeners, but I try to do a little prep work for this show before I go on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I looked up who's going to be on here, and I saw Rich, and I read this article that he wrote about the Seattle Ballet. This season's canon felt like a religious experience. And first of all, it was a very well-written article, but it also made me really think, hey, that I should get down to the ballet, which is something I haven't ever done before, and see it. It was a really good article. I encourage people to take a look at it.
Well, thank you very much.
Nice. Well played, Rich. Well played.
Cheers. Cheers.
Written like a Jehovah's Witness.
Right.
Think of it as a religious experience.
Hey-o.
Right. I like Rich's stuff in The Stranger, too. I hope you don't mind me saying that.
I don't. No,
probably.
Keep going.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
right here. I love you all, too.
Right.
Yeah, so another 15 minutes.
Right.
Listen, they're also over at Seattle Channel, there's a host and producer there, Brian Callanan.
Ugh.
Great stuff. He does a podcast, too, Seattle News, Views, and Brews.
Your coffee break political podcast, Bill. Love
Thank
to have you.
Brian, yeah. thanks
nice.
For coming on.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Finkbeiner.
Yeah, right.
Bill Finkbeiner, I'm glad you're not legislating anymore if it means that that's why you came
is.
To see us.
Right.
Bill, thank you.
Hey, sure,
good luck
thanks,
with your real estate investing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So producer Kevin Kniestadt, did the show. Oh, Eddie Vedder, I hear him. I'm going to shut up so you can hear Pearl Jam. Bernard Ouellette running the board. Hans Twight helping us out. I'm Bill Radke. See you next week.